Welcome to our celebration of Vesak, which is a celebration of the Buddha's birth. And we have the baby Buddha in the flower pagoda, and then his enlightenment, which is represented by him sitting up there in meditation, and then his peaceful passing away, which is now hidden by the flowers. And but before, you could probably see him, the reclining Buddha, as the Buddha as he's passing away. And we have very privileged to have Ajahn Chandoko here with us. Ajahn Chandoko was ordained in Thailand as a monk in 1990. I met him at a Zen center in 1987 or something. He's been involved in Buddhism for a long time, and trained in Thailand with some of the great forest masters, meditation masters there, and now has become an abbot of a monastery in New Zealand. And is the pseudo-abbot of a pseudo-monastery, a new monastery?
Virtual
monastery. how many acres is it?
4.5.
Yeah, 4.5 acres that was bought for him up in Boulder Creek, right? Only a couple of minutes from Vajrapani, Tibetan Retreat Center. And it's an undeveloped property that he's just now going to go and take up residence for the next month there. And it's a little bit of a mystery how he's going to manage it up there, because monks like him don't eat unless people bring him food. And so 4.5 acres and a dirt road behind a dirt road behind a dirt road up a hill with no water. But faith, renunciation, both help. Some days it's faith will support him, and some days renunciation will support him. And I'm delighted that he's coming to the area. It's a tremendous respect for Ajahn Chandoko and his practice and his wisdom, and to have him relatively close by in the peninsula mountains. And it's been a dream for a long time for me that there'd be monastic presence here in the peninsula. So he's not going to be here full time, but because he has responsibilities in New Zealand. But it's nice that he's here. And he was also very graciously willing to come and do our Vesak today. And I told him a little bit about how we usually do it, and told him that that improv style works really well for us as well. So, so thank you and welcome.
Okay. All right. Well, welcome everyone today. I'm actually very grateful to Gil, because in many ways he was. He played an important role, an important part in my life when I was looking for a place to practice Buddhism full time. And he had just come back from Asia, and I met him at a pivotal point. And after speaking to him, I bought a one-way ticket to Thailand. That was over 20 years ago, I think. Okay. Okay, next. Okay. All right. So at this point, actually, before I do the Namo Tassa, I'd like to invite the devas. Now, we have a chant that we do, which is, it dates from ancient times, and it's actually meant to invite the devas, which are positive spiritual forces, to come down specifically to join us for auspicious occasions. And then after that, we can go into the Namo Tassa and take the three refuges.
Avigita citta paritang banantu Sage kame jarupen girisikaratate chandaleke vimane Diperate jagame taruanagane Gehavatum hikete Bhoma chayantun devan jalatala visameya kaganda banaga Titanda sandikeyang muniwa pachanang sadavome sunantu da dasana kalo ayang badanta dhamma savana kalo ayang badanta sangha bahirupasana kalo ayang badanta.
I'll say Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa three times, and after that you can repeat.
Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa.
Okay. Please repeat three times. Take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha.
Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi saṅghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi.
Okay, now I hear the children have a special chant that they're going to teach us. Is that right? Yeah?
Suki Hontu Sabe Sata Suki Hontu Sambe satam suhi hontu. Sambe satam suhi hontu.
Let's do it all together.
Sambe Sata Sukhi Hontu. Sambe Sata Sukhi Hontu.
Sambe Sata Sukhi Hontu.
Okay. All beings, that's a lot of beings. All plants.
One of the best introductions I've ever had. You know, just lowers the expectation. So it's.
Okay, so prepare yourself for a really boring talk. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay. So Vaisak is the celebration of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and passing away. And tradition has it that they all occurred on the full moon of May. So Vaisak is usually the first full moon, or the only full moon in May. This Vaisak is a blue moon Vaisak. Actually, we have two full moons this month, so the whole month has been filled with Vaisak celebrations, because no one knows when to celebrate it. Some people celebrate it the first full moon, some the second, and basically anywhere in between, or afterwards. Now, the Buddha's birth is fairly well documented. The Buddha's death, peaceful passing away into Parinibbana, again, is well outlined in the Parinibbana Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya. What I'd like to talk about tonight, this morning, is the Buddha's enlightenment. Because the idea of enlightenment, the concept of enlightenment, it can be vague, it can be a bit mysterious. What is this all about? But basically, the path of the Buddha, the whole idea of the Dhamma, is to aim towards enlightenment. But, I mean, what is it? If we don't at least have an idea of what it is, an accurate idea of where we're going, then it's difficult to know if we're actually taking the initial steps in the right direction. So I'd like to pick up the story of the Buddha's path to enlightenment and talk a bit about that and the obstacles he encountered, the challenges, and the successes. So we take the story from the point where the Buddha was undergoing, I would say, a bit of a crisis. He was living in the palace. He had basically all most people would hope for. He had financial security. He had job security, right? I mean, he was. People were just waiting for him to take over the realm. He was a prince. He had from what we can tell, a very happy family life. And at the same time, there was some very deep questioning going on in his mind. At a point in his life, in his late 20s, he had encountered the reality of old age, sickness, and death. And so the question started to arise, well, what are we doing this all for? You know, I mean, what's the point of creating a fantastic life if we're just going to die? And having been so sheltered from death, not unlike, say, modern society, then suddenly the reality of death came upon him, and he said, well, you mean everyone I love is going to die? You mean I'm going to die? And just this was enough to create some, yeah, bring up some fundamental questions about what he was going to do with his life and the best way to use a human life. So, the story goes that he finally decided, look, I just need to work this out in my own way. And he left home. And I'm going to talk a bit about the story that's in the suttas, which I would consider the most reliable story. There are a whole variety of different stories and embellishments about the Buddha's life and the path to enlightenment. But I'm going to try to just stick to the story in the suttas. In the story in the suttas, there's no talk of him leaving his wife Yasodhara in the middle of the night, or his newborn baby son in the middle of the night, as is commonly thought of. But he did say that his parents were, you know, they didn't want him to leave, and he left with them in tears. So this whole idea of the initial renunciation of the home life is, it's not an easy thing. As any, most of the monks or nuns that I know, it has been a major decision. You know, it's not something that we take lightly. But he reflected that the words he used was the home life was cramped and dusty. And say, well, how did he mean, you know, cramped and dusty? What exactly does that mean? But the idea that it's just difficult to lead a perfectly pure spiritual life when one has all the responsibilities of the home life, when one has a responsibility with family, with job, with just the amount of time and mental energy it takes to look after all that, and the moral dilemmas that we can find ourselves in. If you own a house, then you have a responsibility to keep it free of termites or cockroaches. Or if you have a restaurant, then you have the responsibility to keep it free of insects. And then what do you do? You know, if you're a Buddhist practitioner, you've got this moral dilemma on your hands. Whereas there's a certain external freedom and, say, internal freedom or opportunity to practice the path 100% going forth. So he went forth, not in any organized institution like we have today, but just as a wanderer, and, you know, just basically going out and following his, call it, inner voice or inner question, and deciding that, you know, I'm just going to find an answer. And I'm going to keep going until I find the answer. So his initial teachers were Alara Kalama and Uddhaka Ramaputta. And quite often you hear the saying, well, the Buddha didn't have a teacher. He didn't have any teachers himself. But actually he did. His initial attempt was to find the greatest teachers of the day, to go to them, see what they had to offer. And so the first teacher he went to was teaching a doctrine of nothingness, which was very advanced, and the teacher was very impressive. After mastering it and being invited to teach the congregation or the sangha with the teacher, He still felt that that hadn't gone far enough. And the words that he uses to describe it are, it still didn't give rise to these qualities of, in Pali, I'll teach you a bit of Pali first, nibbita, viraga, nirodha. And so these are qualities which play a pivotal role in all the Buddhist teachings, from the very beginning right up to the end. So this idea of nibbita is this, it's a way of turning away, actually, turning away from the sensual world, the normal way of looking for happiness. We're all looking for happiness in one way or another. It's to look for it in what we see, what we hear, what we smell, taste, and touch, and mental stimulation. And nibbita is that initial, say, seeing the drawbacks of it, or the shortcomings, the limitations of that, and turning away. Viraga is commonly translated as dispassion. So instead of following passion or encouraging passion, the Buddhist teaching is all about dispassion, like calming passion. And nirodha, which is cessation. Cessation of what? Cessation of all the stresses and problems, the sufferings of life. And peace and direct knowledge. Again, these were qualities that come in this sequence. And he wasn't finding this in this teaching of nothingness. This direct understanding, direct knowledge, or the coolness of a full enlightenment. So even though that teacher considered himself enlightened, and all of the students considered him enlightened, he felt that there was something more, and continued his search. So at this point is when he went off, and he wandered around the country for a while, and eventually settled down at what he considered to be a beautiful little grove next to a nice, clear, flowing river, and with a village for alms round nearby. So, at this point, he decided to try a different tract. Asceticism was a very common way of trying to conquer both the body and the mind. And so he decided there that he was going to follow this path. Now, initially, the ways that he attempted was, one was to try to crush the mind with the mind. So it's important to know that if you find yourself on retreat sometime and you're trying to crush the mind, or crush your thoughts, trying to annihilate your thoughts with the rest of your mind, then that is not a way which works very well. So he did that, and that didn't particularly, it wasn't particularly effective. Then he after crushing the mind with the mind, then it was see, I've crushed my mind, I've crushed all my thoughts. That's what happens. See this. Then he tried the breathless meditation. You know, normally we talk about meditation of mindfulness on the breath. Well, that's what he ended up with. But he started off with the breathless meditation. So he tried not breathing at all. So he blocked up he held his breath with his nose and his mouth, and found that, unfortunately, he was still able to breathe with his ears. So that was a bit of an obstacle. So he blocked up his ears. And then, and held his breath, and he experienced incredible pains and difficulties in that process, to the point where people thought he was dead. So that didn't seem to work. You can see, you know, he's really trying, pulling out all the stops. And then, well, let's try fasting. Right? So he said, well, okay, let's start reducing the food. And he kept reducing the food and reducing the food to the point where he was eating just, say, one little fruit every 2 weeks, or one little grain of rice, or one sesame seed, and, to the point where he was completely emaciated. I mean, just literally skin and bones, where they say if he, you know, tried to grab his spine from the front, you know, he could just grab onto his spine and his backbone. Any time that he, you know, would rub his arms or legs, all the hair would come off, his skin would turn black. And just trying to do basic bodily functions, he would fall over. And he reached the point where he knew he was getting close to death. And he had choices. Either if he continues on this track, then he's probably going to die. But he considered, you can imagine him, you know, completely emaciated, taking this path as far as he could. He said, could it be that there's another path to enlightenment? You can imagine just a glimmer of hope there. You know, could it be? Maybe there's a different way. And then something really important happened. He had a memory of his childhood. And this childhood memory became one of the pivotal points in his whole spiritual quest. And one of the pivotal points that formed an important basis for his teaching throughout his whole career. He had the memory of when he was a young child and his father was the king undergoing a plowing ceremony, which is still even in Thailand, was a regular thing that the kings would do. And while this was going on, you know, it was a bit boring for the child. So he sat underneath a tree in a nice cool place. No one else was around. And his mind just spontaneously went into a very deep and peaceful state of meditation, which quite often happens if we're not really trying. If we just get ourselves out of the way, then the mind just goes really peaceful. And he remembered that time. And he remembered how profound that was. And so the thought came up, could this be the path? Maybe this is the path. Because what had happened at that time was his mind went into a state where it was so deep that it's what we call jhana. Jhana is a term in Pali which signifies a particular depth of meditation and concentration. And he thought, yeah, that was extremely powerful, meaningful, gave a great sense of clarity, and it was really pleasant. Now, up until this time, the whole idea of asceticism was you don't just deny yourself physical pleasure, but you also deny yourself mental pleasure. So he started to reconsider his whole attitude towards pleasure and said, well, why am I afraid of the mental pleasure? Why am I afraid of you know, the peace or joy that comes not through self-indulgence, but it comes from within. It comes from within our own heart. And so, you know, well, why am I afraid of that? And just through his own reflection, he started to think that, yeah, right, maybe this is the path. And even today, it's important to see how important, well, it's important to see how fundamental it is to have enjoyment in meditation. So meditation is not merely a hard slog. It's not merely something that we force ourselves to do because we think it's good for ourselves. But it's something that it's good to enjoy. We can allow ourselves to enjoy it. Now, this happiness that comes from concentration, he says, is not something to be feared. I mean, even today, you have certain meditative traditions that will say, well, if you're starting to get some happiness coming up in your meditation, we'll stay away from that. Don't go there. Right? This is, you'll get attached to it. And that's precisely the type of asceticism that the Buddha turned away from. He said, well, there's actually nothing wrong with the happiness that comes from within the meditation. In fact, joy and happiness and tranquility, these are factors of enlightenment. These are important aspects that are going to lead to full enlightenment. And so he started to reconsider his extreme asceticism. And at that point, he said, well, if I'm going to develop this deep concentration and what it will lead to, then I'm going to need a bit more bodily strength. And so he decided to take some plain boiled rice and bread. And at this time, he was accompanied by five other attendant ascetics. And once they saw that he had taken some plain boiled rice and bread, they thought, well, he's given up. He'd taken it to the limit, but he just gave up. They said, the quote was, he's reverted to luxury. these guys were really hardcore. he just had plain boiled rice, and he gets criticized for reverting to luxury. It's a good thing he wasn't in the valley. He would have, imagine if he had had, say, like salmon quiche and a cappuccino. What they would have said then. But even with plain boiled rice and bread, they got disgusted with him and they took off. But the Buddha was undaunted, or at this point he was not yet the Buddha, but he was the Buddha to be, or Bodhisattva. So the Bodhisattva then, he wandered again, continued, and there is another traditional story which is not found in the sutta story of when he goes to sit underneath a tree and a young woman named Sujata offers him milk rice. And this is such a classic part of the traditional story that I'll say a little bit about it, but if you look in the suttas, it's actually missing. You only find that story in the commentaries, in the Jataka Nidana or the Mahavastu. You find that story. But there was this young woman who would make annual sacrifices to her, the god who lived in the tree in her yard. And the Buddha happened to be, the Bodhisattva happened to be sitting underneath that tree one day. So she thought that, well, that's the god, that's the local deity. So she offered him rice. And to this day, there still is a village just outside of Bodh Gaya, which is called Sujata Village. And I remember the first time that I went on pilgrimage in India with a few other monks, we went an alms round to that village. We didn't have to, but we just decided that we wanted to go on alms round just as a way of honoring the Buddha, going to Sujata Village. And these days, Sujata Village is probably not that different than it was 2,500 years ago. It is very, very simple. And we arrived, three of us Western monks, and they weren't Buddhas. They were Hindu. And, they looked at us and they didn't speak any English. And took the lids off our bowl and kind of looked in and saw that it was empty. And through a few kind of hand gestures, then they got the idea pretty quickly. Initially they said, oh, yes, right. And pretty much the whole village came out, grandmas down to little children were surrounding us. And they initially tried to give us some uncooked rice. They said, no, sorry, we need only cooked food, please. So this old grandmother who had been making these cow patties with the cow manure, and making patties of that, she kind of wiped off her hand like this and got the bowl of dal and then reached into the dal with her hands and threw it in her bowl. But she did it in such a sweet way that we felt very grateful. And we went back and we ate it. And I'm still alive today. It's probably had a lot of fiber in it. But that was a very moving time, because from Sujata Village, then you have Naranjara River, And just beyond that is Bodhgaya and the Bodhi tree. And even from Sujata village, as you start to cross the river, you can see the big monument at Bodhgaya. And so it was just such a moving thing to feel that we are walking in the Buddha's footsteps from Sujata village. Because from that point on, tradition has it, although you don't find it in the sutta rendition, tradition has it that the bowl that he was served this milk rice in, once he was finished, he set it down in the Narendra River. And he said, if I am to attain full enlightenment on this night, then let the bowl float upstream.